Accession number 1068, rule 4.
Mr. Beverton, rule 4.
We worked closely with the Americans, but I feel that they had the advantage over us because they had ready-to-hand Japanese translators for the Nisei Japanese people who came from the Californian coast area. And they knew the idiomatic Japanese, which our translators or interpreters probably didn't. But we did liaise with them, and found them a moderate help. But the information that we had was sent back to base for further developments, or occasionally we might send some of our imprisoned personnel back to further interrogation elsewhere. But that's all I can say about the work at the moment.
How much pressure on you was there to get results?
No pressure put on at all. We were, as long as we kept up, I mean, didn't get ourselves in difficult waters with the Thai authorities or the allies, allied forces, that seemed to be the best method of progress. But I had a feeling that although information was still required and sent back, the unit itself was gradually folding up, because before I went to Singapore, a large number of personnel in the area, from the Americans and the Australians and the New Zealanders who were with us, were sort of, and the Dutch for that matter, were sort of going home on leave before they were being released from the services. So in other words, they were sort of time-filling. I mean, it seems as if that the bulk of the work was being got through on a very sort of ad hoc basis rather than sort of in detailed interrogations.
What was the demeanour of the Japanese and Thais whom you were screening?
Very helpful. I mean, they seem to take orders easily, and so you ask them to do something and they do it. They didn't seem to be averse to going and taking on the most menial of tasks, and they were ready to oblige with all the information that they had at their fingertips, which was very limited, admittedly, because it seemed to repeat itself. But I think the top brass that we had earlier on had already been moved on their way to, I mean, the people who were leaders of the Kempe Thai movement had already gone from the area, as far as I could tell, and we were left with the ordinary NCO types, and who were sort of small fry in the organisation.
How were they being treated?
They've been treated quite well, and they seem to accept a lower standard of food and hygiene than we did. I mean, their ration of rice, which to us would seem very uniform and very meagre, was adequate for their purposes. I mean, they could survive on far less than we could.
Did they complain to you at all?
No, I had no complaints sent to me. There may have been complaints sent to the other officers in the unit, interrogators, but I had no knowledge of any complaints at all. I think they were pleased to be out of the war because of things weren't going their way, even though Thailand was insulated from the main activities, and it was just a backwater by comparison, because no fighting had taken place in there until British troops arrived after the war had finished. And the Americans were there first, as far as I know. The Americans were set up base, and they still aren't there. Although we had no contact with the British diplomatic forces services in Bangkok, we did have contact with the American embassy, which I think was set up as soon as the war had finished. And before I left to go back, or to go on south to Singapore, I was entertained with two colleagues of mine at the American embassy for a farewell dinner, not like the Sobitz Kai, but on amicable buddy terms.
What work were you expected to do in Singapore from May 1946?
Well, it ceased to be Japanese interrogation or Japanese translation. I still did some, but I was mainly given... I was attached to the... what do we call it in military terms? Intelligence G2, I think it was, I was attached to it. I worked in the Singapore barracks of Canning Island, I think it was called, the headquarters in the castle with a general in command. And I was assigned to economical and political work in the area, which meant translating all documents that were sent to the Singapore Central Office, if they needed translating, if they were from Indochina, or Dutch, of course they were done by Dutch people, or Indochinese people, or French people. Malays did their own information, and all work was eventually sent on to the MI6, and I summarised it at the end of the month and sent out a situation report, which went over to Thailand, Burma, Indochina, Malaya, and so forth, as a sort of periodical documentation report of economic situations and progress. It was a mixture of political, economic progress. And anything which related to agents was immediately forwarded to MI6. So it's a question of assessing the importance, the relative values, and the dissemination of the work accordingly, wherever it came in and to whom it was going to be sent. It was the time of the beginning of the communist trade union troubles in Malaysia and Singapore, as you probably know, when there was a large underground communist element which was fighting, or had been fighting against the Japanese, mainly Chinese, who had been visibly enemies of the Japanese. And, of course, information came through from our agents about their activities. And on one occasion, I remember, I was working late at the office doing some decoding, and a message had come through indicated that there was going to be strike action taking place in the docks, in the Singapore docks, and there might be some guns used, and I had to get the information to the general in charge of Singapore as quick as possible. Well, the G1, G2 had gone, and I was just an ordinary lieutenant, below the sort, as it were, on the table. And I thought the only way I can get something organised straight away is by getting in touch with the general. So I saw his ADC in his office and got access to the general straight away with my hot information. And the general set the ball rolling to go and counteract or any problems that might be arising. I assume, I don't know what he actually did, but anyway, I felt that I'd done my task. But the following morning I got complete bollocking from my immediate superior for not using the proper channels, the G2, G1, and so forth, through to the ADC and so on. Well, as I said, if I'd waited the following morning, it'd probably have been too late. I wasn't to know. And I suppose I did jump the gun, but at any rate, I thought I did the right thing. But I still was smart under the military intelligence officer's criticism of me for what I had done. But that was the only occasion when I crossed swords with them. Most of the time, we got on quite amicably. I was working in the same office. Life became rather more tedious, though, I think, with the political work I was doing, because I felt that there were other people in the agents that I was being bypassed, because I was due for my military retirement, because I had applied for Class B demobilisation to go back to university, and the university had got in touch with the authorities. I think it must have been from about August onwards, and I arrived in Singapore in May, and in July or August, I think the B demobilisation recommendation had come through that I should be released by October in time for the new term at Bristol University. And so therefore, they obviously knew this. And so my days were numbered. And so although I still maintain the political economic document which I sent out, counterintelligence work became minimal after the after August.
How seriously was the communist threat politically and in the trade unions viewed in Malaya at that time?
It was viewed quite seriously. I don't think they realised how strong the communists were, because several of the communist leaders had been sort of paid functionaries of the British behind-the-line groups, and they had worked well in attacking Japanese groups, rooting out Japanese groups that were taken to the jungle, because a lot of the Japanese had gone hiding in the jungle, and it was sometimes difficult to go and get them out, but the communists who were in the jungle already were able to sort of root them out because they knew the difference between Japanese and Chinese, whereas the average Englishman looking for Japanese as opposed to Chinaman can't always tell the difference, particularly when you see something at quick intervals, not close quarters. So I think that the British government was sort of lulled into a false sense of security by the fact that they had previously been allies and now suddenly were flexing their muscles as they had been underground activists behind our lines. They wanted recognition. They did all the hard work and they resented the fact that the British were coming back and taking over one colonial yoke of the Japanese to a second colonial yoke back to the British. And I had the feeling that although certain Chinese members were regarded with suspicion because they were rather too outspoken and had contacts with people in sensitive areas in Singapore headquarters, Singapore government sources, although there wasn't any real government in the country at the moment, they felt that they might sort of be trying to get a stranglehold on the economy of the island by strikes. So when this strike came through, which was over conditions and pay, and the talk of guns was being mentioned, then obviously it was felt that action of a sterner kind was necessary. Whether it was opening the eyes of the British authorities or more, I don't know. I'm not at the top of the echelon to know what the senior people were thinking.
Did you have any sense in 1946 that what was to happen later in 1948, which was a virtual insurrection led by the communists in Malaya, might be about
yes,
to occur?
I don't know. I don't mean to how soon we expected it to happen, the insurrection, but I think the authorities were becoming jittery about it or aware of it, because I was able to be. I used to drive myself around in a jeep first of all. Then an instruction came through headquarters saying that in future, no officer was allowed to be driven. Was allowed to go and drive a jeep himself. He must have a driver. And get authority for using military personnel carriers. So I happen to know an MT officer, Indian, who was in charge of the MT park outside town, and I managed to catch a motorbike from him. So as I'd done motorbike training in the army back in Rider Street days, I managed to borrow this motorbike unofficially, and I was still mobile, so I could get from where I stayed outside Singapore in the Orchard Flats. Orchard Road Flats, I had a flat there, back to headquarters on Canning Island, Fort Canning. But I feel that was the beginnings of lessening the chances of officers being picked off. I mean, there was no sniping, but there was a trade in guns. I mean, even I had an automatic Browning automatic, which I'd picked up from Siam, or one of my fellow colleagues in Siam, who was a gun maniac in many respects. He collected Mausers, and you mentioned it, he'd got it. And he had several Browning automatics, which he let me have as one as a protection, because my revolver was still in its grease for paper, and I had brought it over the Far East and I hadn't used it at all. But an automatic is much more able to kick into action than an ordinary Webley revolver. And I just felt that there was more activity coming through on the grapevine about communists infiltrating the unions or coming into power through contacts with functionaries in the governmental departments of Malaysia or Singapore in particular. But a friend of mine, actually, a chap called Russell, can't mention his name, I suppose, because he was just a colleague. We used to go out together with some of the girls in the area, and we used to take a jeep up to Kota Tinggi, which is a waterfall area in Kota Baru. And we used to have to go armed because of the possibilities of, wayfarers or communists in the jungle, or they weren't called communists, but anybody in the jungle who might take a few pot shots at us. And eventually, not long after I'd left Singapore to return to England, this chap, Russell, was killed on such a jaunt. So, I mean, whether he was killed by a communist gunman, I don't know. But the point is, it did mean that things were hotting up. And that was way back in 1946, August, September.
What did the attitude of the local people, Chinese, Malays, Tamils, seem to be towards you as a British person in Malaya at the time? Were they friendly or hostile? Was there any anti-colonialist feeling or what that was demonstrated to you personally?
I had no hostile feeling demonstrated at all. When I was in the flats at Orchard Road, which wasn't my last destination, incidentally, I had a Japanese valet, I suppose you'd call him, most embarrassing actually. I've got his photograph in my album upstairs. But he would insist on trying to dress me, and of course, when he sort of came along and started buttoning up my shirt buttons and so forth, and having all my clothes got ready for him, I felt very embarrassed. But he was quite subservient. But I suppose this is the general attitude of the Japanese private towards officers of any kind, their own as well as British. Of the local people, the people I met with mainly, both in Bangkok and in Singapore, were very friendly. In Bangkok, I got to know a dance hostess, not through going to the dance hall, but waiting at a tram stop outside her house when the rain came down, the monsoon rain came down like hell, and she took me in, and we became friends, and all her personnel became very friendly over a period of several months. And she invited me to the Jasmine Wine Bar, where she was hostess. And I had a free table any night I wanted to go, which was very charming. I had free meals from the house, met people who worked in the Japanese ministry. I admit, working as I was in counter-espionage, I found asking them questions was an advantage to me, because I could sound the waters of the Siamese ministry people. I mean, I didn't know many of them, but two of them did pay frequent visits to this place of this Siamese girl, and I found them very friendly. One of whom just wanted to come to England to improve his English. I mean, he did speak a bit of English, which I was quite surprised about. But in Singapore and Malaysia, I didn't meet anybody on the Malayan mainland, but in Singapore Island, they were all Chinese that I met, rather Malays, although I had a Malay boy to look after me as well, eventually when I moved into a new house. The Chinese people I met in shops, in bars, at the cafe house, which was the radio station in 1945-46, the only tall skyscraper they had in the whole town. Also, if any, they allowed me to go and attend various broadcasting sessions when they were putting on Malayan guitar music. And I was allowed to go and sit in and watch and listen in to what they were doing. And I didn't meet any of them off duty outside, going out and about pubs and so forth, or cafes and so forth. But people I used to meet with and talk to were always very friendly, and I didn't think it was subservience friendliness. I mean, it wasn't like the Japanese, where they were sort of bowing and kowtowing, as the Japanese tend to do, I know, in their own country, which is part of their culture. But you had the feeling that it would talk to you as equals. And I found I got along with them quite well. They didn't know what I was doing. They just knew I was in the army, because I wore an army uniform. And that was that.
So nobody said to you, why don't you British go home? You're colonial people whom we don't want.
No, not at all. I mean, of course, I suppose you get insulated against it to some extent, but even going into the Brave New World, I think it was they called themselves a sort of fairground, circus ground in Singapore. I mean, there was no feeling of that you'd like to be knifed or shot at or captured or taken away as a prisoner and interrogated. The atmosphere was very warm, and but of course the people I met mainly were obviously, I suppose, of a middle class or merchant class rather than the working class. And they were shopkeepers or people who worked in restaurants or people who worked in the broadcasting corporation.
If I could go back to something earlier in your life when you went to Germany pre-war, can you tell me whereabouts you went and when? I think you mentioned Leverkusen.
Well, the only place I went to actually was Cologne the first time I went there, and I stayed in a suburb of Cologne. Name I can't remember. And the people I stayed with were definitely upper middle class, because they were, you sort of left your shoes outside the door to be cleaned by the servants downstairs. And when the German boy came to stay with us, he left his shoes outside his bedroom for my mother to clean, and he got short shrift from that, as I can tell you. I pointed out to him that in England we don't have servants, we clean our own shoes. But the second place I went to, and the third, and for the third visit both times, was at Leverkusen, Wiesdorf, which is just outside the Cologne, just the north of Cologne. And his father was a director in IG Farben industry, Bayer. You've heard of Bayer?
Yes.
And they had a flat in the high street. And I got acquainted with him very closely. Also his friends, we went swimming together. We went to the local church together, because one of his friends, Ulrich, was his father was a pastor in the Evangelische Kirche next door to where they lived. And his mother and father were very houseproud people. They took me on holiday with them when they went to the Westerwald, which is south of Koblenz, in the hunting area. And we went boar hunting. And we had to go up these hides, which are up trees in huts. And I was given my first chance to fire a rifle. I'm afraid I missed and shot the trees. I mean, I couldn't see the boars from the trees, actually. But that was when I wore my Hitler Youth uniform. I mean, it was just a borrowed one. I wasn't a member of the Hitler Youth, but I just wore this uniform, so I looked like the rest of the boys on the trip. But and we went to a place called, I think it was Oberzeutsheim was the name of the village, which is a village near Lahn, which I think is the Westerwald, the Western Forest, isn't it? And they were very right-wing, obviously imbued with National Socialism, or the trappings of National Socialism. We didn't discuss politics, but obviously they were flag-waving, drum-beating, youthful members of the Hitlerjugend. And I fell in line, because I was a Boy Scout back at home in England. And to me, wearing a uniform when you're a teenager is just an ideal sort of thing. And carrying a dagger was a bit better than carrying a woggle and a staff.
Which years would you have been there?
1937, 8, and I was 1936, 7 and 8. I went, and I would have gone in 1939. I had tickets to go to Germany in 1939, but I wasn't allowed to leave the country. Our German friends came and stayed with us in August 1939, and he got very worried seeing all the British guns limbering around the streets and convoys of army trucks going along through Gants Hill, Eastern Avenue, around our hometown. And he got cold feet and thought he ought to be back in Germany in case he didn't get back in time. Unfortunately, when I got in touch with his family after the war, I found that he'd been lost, missing on the Russian front. And his mother welcomed me, as they had no other children, welcomed me as a lost son. And she was in tears and called me her boy, which was very heartrending. And that was after the war, when I got back to England, 1947, I think it was, I went back to Germany again. Actually, it wasn't until, it must have been after 1947, because I went back to university in 46. And in 47, I became the first, a member of the Anglo-Austrian Society. And as I was the only married student in the group going, I was leader of a party of students from English universities going to Austria to re-cement the, the breach that had been brought by the war between Austria and Germany and England.
When you were in Germany before the war, what was the attitude towards Britain and British people that you personally came across?
Well, they had a feeling of superiority, I would say, because I wasn't a really broad-chested youth, and they poked fun at me for my shallow-chestedness. The fact that I couldn't swim as fast as they could also labelled me as a bit of a weakling, and therefore their gestures were that England's not as tough as Germany. And they were very proud of their uniforms and asked me why I didn't wear a uniform in England. And I said I was a Boy Scout. And when I said I was a Boy Scout, they said, huh, ha, 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 sort of thing. Boy Scouts don't do what we do over in Germany. And I had to admit it. And I can understand how they can be carried away by it, because I was, by the bunting and the flag waving and the swastikas, and when you hear a military band going past in the streets, you feel, you know, the German has that marching tempo, and it's very dynamic, and it makes you feel you want to go and march with it, just as an English marching band does. But the Germans have that greater emphasis. So I found they were a little bit feeling of superiority towards England, and they felt that they had the edge over our country altogether. But they were polite, friendly, and teasing is the right word, I suppose. But this German superiority was also apparent when I went back to see Germans that I had known. Not so much the people I'd known, but other people who didn't know me as a friend, but who recognised me as a member of the victorious Entente. And I'd have Germans coming along and actually spitting at my feet in front of me to show their disgust that they had lost the war. And that went very much against the grain, because I felt nothing but sympathy towards the Germans, who'd suffered as a result of Hitler's bombastic